Good evening, everyone. We are just moments away from Al Gore, who's here in Angelica Hall at Dominican University of California tonight, the 13th of February, 2013, to promote his new book, The Future. Vice President Al Gore coming up in just moments, right here on radio.dominican.edu.
There's such a lot of excitement in this hall. This is wonderful. I'm Elaine Petrocelli from Book Passage, and I am here to give us a little pre-remarks. The first one is the most important, which is please, please, please turn off your cell phone. I'd be so appreciative if you do. And also to let you know that we have a wonderful official Dominican photographer here this evening. Stuart will be getting a whole disc of pictures, which will be up on the website, on the Dominican and the Book Passage websites, so you'll be able to see pictures. We'd really appreciate it if you didn't use flash cameras during the lecture. That would be just... So if you have a camera with you, please do not use a flash during the lecture. This lecture series is a huge pleasure for Book Passage. We love working with Dominican University, with Dr. Lucy and President Mary Marcy and all of their folks. And this is just the beginning of a great week, because a week from tomorrow night, Madeleine Albright will be here, right here on this stage, and to talk about her book, Prague Winter, and I have the fun of interviewing her on stage. I am really excited. And Lieutenant Governor Newsom will be here on March 6th. Now, I know you know we have lots more lectures, but I just wanted to tell you about those two. And in the meantime, I hope that you'll come to all of our lectures. It's going to be a great night tonight. Dr. Lucy will be out in about 1 minute to get things started, just to give you time to get those phones off. And, oh, I'm supposed to tell you one more thing. Vice President Gore, in order to have time for plenty of questions, we have had all the books signed in advance. And so you all have already got your signed books. They'll be selling more back there. And after you hear Vice President Gore, you're going to need about 10 more. And the Book Passage staff will be very happy about that. If you have questions, I have all these cards with questions, and this will give us time to do more of them. So I'm so glad we're doing it this way. And now I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Denise Lucy, from the Director of the Institute for Leadership Studies from Dominican University.
We're all here. All right. Welcome. Welcome to Dominican University of California. And it is my pleasure again to say, what a night. Isn't this an amazing opportunity for us in Marin County to have Vice President Gore here? Yes. And our students are in the hall with our neighbors, and we're here to really be together to talk and listen about really important change issues. So I'm thrilled that you're here. As you know, as Elaine has said, this is a really important partnership that we have with Book Passage, the most important independent bookstore, and it's in our neighborhood. Thank you, Book Passage, for helping us to support this program. And you know, it's a leadership lecture series. So that means that we are seeking to find ways to feature and highlight important acts of leadership. And what better one that than we will hear tonight. So I wanted to just thank Private Ocean Wealth Management, our lead sponsor, very crucially important partner to have a sponsor like this that cares about the community. And this is the second year that they have sponsored this program for us, and we are so thrilled. Private Ocean Personal Powerful Wealth Management is the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firm in Marin and has been named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide. It's our honor to have their CEO, Richard Stone, on our board. And it's really a pleasure because Mr. Stone is also a great leader. He's been CEO since its founding, and it's really a thrill to have him. He's also the recipient of the prestigious Charles Schwab Impact Award for lifetime contributions to financial planning industry. And as a member of our Board of Trustees, it's a pleasure and honor to introduce Mr. Richard Stone, who will introduce to us Mr. Al Gore.
Good evening. As a trustee of Dominican University of California, I'm delighted to welcome you to our leadership lecture series. It also gives me great pleasure to welcome back to this series Vice President Al Gore. This is Mr. Gore's third appearance as part of our popular leadership lecture series. In 2007, he joined us to discuss his book, The Assault on Reason. In 2009, Mr. Gore talked with us about our choice. This evening, he will discuss his latest book, The Future. In it, he provides a clear assessment of 6 critical drivers of global change in the decades to come. Mr. Gore is co-founder and chairman of Generation Investment Management and chairman of the Climate Reality Project, a nonprofit devoted to solving the climate crisis. We could have used him last week when it was really cold. Yeah. Mr. Gore was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives 4 times and the U.S. Senate 2 times. He served 8 years as Vice President of the United States. In 1999, Mr. Gore became the Democratic Party nominee for the 2000 presidential election. In 2007, he was co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of his work focused on drawing attention to the dangers of global warming. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Al Gore.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. I love this venue. I love Dominican University. It's so great to be back. And I want to thank Richard Stone for introducing me. And also, Richard, thank you for co-sponsoring this speaker series. I also want to acknowledge the president of Dominican University, Mary Marcy, who has done a terrific job and hosted me at her home, the Borowski House. And by the way, let me acknowledge the chairman of the board of Dominican University, Andy Borowski, who is a friend and neighbor of mine, actually, and for the days that I'm in San Francisco. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, but I'm out in San Francisco quite a bit. I want to thank the faculty and staff and students at Dominican University. I want to thank Dr. Denise Lucy, the institute director who spoke earlier. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank my dear friend, Elaine Petricelli, who is the head of Book Passage. And let's support independent local bookstores. They're a foundation of democracy. God bless you. Elaine and her wonderful team have hosted 2 of my daughters who wrote books and have been out here. And I just think of Marin County as the epicenter of the rebellion. And that's a Star Wars metaphor for some of you who don't pick it up right away. It's great to be back here, and it's been such a privilege to come here several times. And I feel as passionately about this book as any book I have ever written. I commend it to you. When I was at President Marcy's home with my partner in life, Liz Cadle, we were up there having a wonderful reception, and we had a nice dinner. But before that, we had an assembly line set up in the back of the house where I have signed books for everybody, and the ink is barely dry on them. First of all, let me say, this book began 8 years ago when I was making a speech in Europe and at a conference where someone asked me the question, what are the drivers of global change? And I gave an answer that I thought was adequate, and truth to tell, I thought it was more than adequate. But when I got on the plane to fly back to the United States, that question kind of nagged at me a little bit, and I took out my computer and started making an outline, and for 6 hours, I continued to move things around, and when I got back home, I kept on working on it, and I kept collecting string, so to speak, and I found soon thereafter that this outline had some value in the real world. Here's what I mean by that. Dominican, by the way, has a green MBA program. I co-founded an investment business called Generation Investment Management that with my partner, David Blood. By the way, I wanted to name it Blood and Gore. I hope you won't think less of me when I tell you that I really did want to name it Blood and Gore. But the other partners wouldn't go along with that. And we focus on sustainable investing. And we have been attempting to prove the business case for almost a decade now that if you look at investing through a sustainability lens, you do not have to sacrifice value for values. Knock on wood, it has been extremely successful. But the reason I tell you that story is that the outline that became this book was a key part of our investment model. It has been tested in the real world of business and investments. And about 2 years ago, I decided to turn this into a book. And I cleared all the furniture out of my living room in Nashville and set up giant whiteboards and directed research that produced 15,000 pages. By then, the drivers of global change had settled into what I regard as the six most important drivers of global change. And I want to tell you a little bit about them, and then I very much look forward to responding to your questions. Many of you have written questions on cards, and Elaine's going to come up here afterwards and articulate quite a few of those questions, and I look forward to that. To begin with, in the introduction to this book, I make a big point about the principle of emergence, and we all use that word. I want to tell you when I first became fascinated by the concept of emergent change. When I was a young member of the House of Representatives and elected in 1976, I fell in with a bipartisan group of members of Congress, both House and Senate, who had just formed a group called the Congressional Clearinghouse on the Future. And it had been started by a senior congressman from North Carolina. And in my second term, he asked me to chair this. And we had hundreds of the leading futurists and deep thinkers, and we'd invite them to come into the Congress, and we had Alvin Toffler and John Nesbitt and Buckminster Fuller and Margaret Mead and Carl Sagan and lots and lots and lots of them. The one visiting scholar and expert who perhaps had the biggest impact on me was a short, balding scientist from Belgium. He had actually been born in Russia 3 months before the Russian Revolution in 1917, but then moved with his family to Belgium and was educated there. And he had just won, in the late 1970s, had just won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for discovering a major corollary to the second law of thermodynamics. Now, don't get worried. I'm not going to get lost in the arcana of this, but it's actually an important point that's one of the keys to this book. The second law of thermodynamics is called entropy. And what it teaches us is that systems in nature break down over time. They dissipate. Think of a smoke ring. It begins as a coherent donut, and then as the molecules separate, it dissipates into the air. And some systems dissipate quickly, others dissipate slowly over time. Prigogine discovered what is, in effect, the opposite of entropy. When you have an open system with energy that flows into the system and through it and out again, and when the energy flow increases significantly above a threshold, two things happen in sequence. Number one, the system breaks down. It can't handle the new flows of energy. But then, and this is the part that's pretty amazing, the system reorganizes itself at a higher level of complexity, and the energy flow continues. Now think about that for just a moment. It is, instead of a dissipative, essentially destructive process, it is a process of creation. A new form appears spontaneously through self-organization. The entire field of knowledge known as complexity theory, which built upon chaos theory, is really based on that discovery by Ilya Prigogine. The way that many of us use the word emergence or the phrase emergent phenomenon really derives from Prigogine's discovery. It is a new law of nature. It is also a powerful metaphor for understanding a process of change in our world, in our universe, that is different from the standard process of change that we are used to seeing in our everyday lives. We experience change normally as a gradual, linear process of change where things change incrementally in a predictable pattern from one step to the next. But sometimes the potential for much larger changes builds up without expressing itself because it piles up against a barrier that keeps it from being manifest until the potential for change reaches a critical mass and breaks through the barrier and then bursts forth or emerges full-blown as a brand new pattern, distinct and different from what we have known and experienced in the past. Think now, applying it as a metaphor, think about what has happened in our world with the introduction of the internet and the World Wide Web. Newspapers are going bankrupt. Not all, but many in every country. But what is emerging? Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat, you can go down your own list, and the overall flows of information are much larger. They're different, more complex. And the pattern is one that's entirely new. Joseph Schumpeter, a long time ago, created the phrase creative destruction, a process of change that is in some ways similar to the phenomena that I'm describing. The reason I begin with that scientific discovery and the metaphor that derives from it is that the six drivers of global change that I describe in this book are all emergent phenomena. They're new. And they have appeared in our world as very powerful new realities that challenge us. They are, in many respects, unfamiliar to us. And they bring the fraternal twins of peril and opportunity. And the underlying theme of this book is that we as human beings, and particularly we as citizens of the United States of America, more about that in a moment, have a responsibility to consciously participate in making choices about how we react to these emergent changes so that we can seize the opportunities more readily and safeguard the future against recognizable perils that might put human values at risk. Number one, I'm going to go through the six now, and then before going to your questions, I'll circle back to some of the common themes that tie all six of these drivers of global change together. Number one, Earth Inc. We are all used to reading about the globalization of the economy. I believe that the globalization of the world's economy has now reached a stage where it has crossed a threshold. And now it has, Earth Inc. has, a holistic integrity and reality of its own that gives the global economy a brand new relationship to national governments and to the three classic factors of production: labor, capital, and natural resources. We now have virtual factories that extend their supply chains to hundreds of countries and employ labor in many different countries, moving jobs across international boundaries with ease. And the ability of workers to speak up and say, "I need higher wages," is diminished, because jobs can easily be relocated. It also changes the ability of national and regional jurisdictions to say, we need higher taxes because the processes that are legally associated with the creation of value and taxable income can also be easily relocated. Outsourcing is familiar to us, but I argue in this book, in chapter one, that outsourcing and robo-sourcing, a new advanced level of automation, are two sides of the same coin. Automation, and really the very advanced forms of automation that are now rushing quickly into the economy, replace jobs in a very different way. We've all learned in economics and history that the Luddites, hundreds of years ago, were sadly mistaken. And the evidence from the study of economic history amply proves that new technologies almost always create more new jobs than they displace. But many economists now believe that the evidence is beginning to demonstrate the possibility that that may not be true anymore. Why? Because the advanced technologies that incorporate intelligence and extend and magnify not only our physical capacities, but also our cognitive functions, are now displacing whole categories of employment so rapidly that it becomes more difficult for those who lose their jobs to find new occupations that pay wages and salaries at a level anywhere near what they used to receive. One quick example. Some law firms are now using a new algorithm that makes it possible for one first-year lawyer to compile as much legal research as used to require 500 first-year lawyers. And the level of accuracy, the number, is much greater. The number of mistakes is much lower. And all those, the other 499 first-year lawyers will find work somewhere else. But if the other law firms are beginning to use the same new technology, maybe they won't end up in those law firms. Accountants. I could go down the list of professions that reward skills that have a very high level of thinking and represent jobs of the kind that we always assumed would remain the unique province of our species. There is more than enough work to be done. But much of the work that now needs to be done is not routinely compensated in markets. We need more mental health care. We need more child care. We need more education. We need more environmental cleanup. We need more scientific R&D. And some of the work that people will do in the future in larger numbers is work that falls in the category of public goods, not private goods. But the prevailing ideology of our age has been pulling decisions from democratic processes into markets, from public policies toward private actors. And we may need soon to reevaluate whether or not we in fact do have the right to work together through the instruments of self-government to decide that some of these tasks that need to be performed are ones that should be compensated by government. Now, let me continue. Capital flows. I talked about labor. What we've seen in the U.S. is the middle class has been hollowed out. Wages for most of Americans have not been increasing. I'll talk in a moment about the inequality of income that's growing. But Earth Inc. is now driving policy in country after country, including our own. And the new technologies that are now coming over the horizon, like 3D printing, are extremely exciting. And they, for example, hold the prospect of bringing a lot of manufacturing jobs that have been outsourced back to the United States. But as it comes back, manufacturing will not bring with it the intensity of employment that it once had. And Earth Inc., by definition, is global. And the robo-sourcing I've just alluded to is not taking place only in the U.S. In China, there is a famous company called Foxconn. Some of you have heard of it. It makes many of the smartphones and digital devices. Foxconn just announced that over the next 3 years, it is deploying 1 million robots. So many of the young Chinese men and women who have moved from the impoverished rural areas of China to Guangzhou and other centers of manufacturing closer to the coast, closer to the export centers, may have real difficulty competing with these intelligent robots. What then? These are some of the questions that Earth Inc. will pose for all of us, not only in the United States. Capital flows are also different in Earth Inc. Computers actually are in control or make the instant-by-instant decisions that drive the majority of capital flows in the world. Exotic financial instruments, such as the derivative products that some of you know about, some of them are actually difficult to distinguish from gambling, truly, but the overall flow of wealth around the world at the speed of light, represented by these derivatives, is many times larger than the flows that represent real transactions in the buying and selling of real goods and real services. Natural resources. I'll come back to this when I talk about the fourth driver of change, but we are now voraciously consuming natural resources at a rate that is causing some significant problems. But let me move on. I can't spend too much time on any one of these. I do have a suggestion if you want to know more about any of them. The second driver of global change is the emergence of what I call the global mind. The connection of the thoughts and feelings of billions of people around the world at the speed of light. Not only to one another, but also to an increasing array of intelligent devices and machines and sensors that are being embedded throughout the world, and vast databases that give us the ability to instantly gain access to a full universe of knowledge. I'm sure I'm hardly the only one here who has been in conversations at the dinner table where suddenly everything stops while somebody looks up something on their smartphone. Nor am I the only one here who's had the experience of being with loved ones in a living room where everybody's present, but nobody's talking to one another because everybody's on a different device. 40% of the people who have smartphones look at them first thing in the morning when they open their eyes before they even get out of bed. And then, of course, they face a new hazard driving to work because all the other drivers are looking at smartphones. It's changing the way we think. Some people, when they try to remember something now, if it's difficult, they don't try too hard. They just ask Dr. Google instead. Every new communications technology has reorganized consciousness. The invention or the perfection by the ancient Greeks of the phonetic alphabet, invented by the Phoenicians, is associated with the sudden emergence of dramatic theater and philosophy and complex concepts like democracy. Why? Because the brain was reorganized. The forms of writing prior to the phonetic alphabet relied on pictograms, hieroglyphics, cuneiform, symbols that carried with each one a representation of the concept for which they stood. But all of a sudden, when the phonetic alphabet presented a series of squiggles that had absolutely no intrinsic meaning in and of themselves, but when used in combination, could be assigned gestalt meanings that required our brains to remember the gestalt and to not focus on the individual symbols. That reorganized thought and the sophisticated ways of thinking that kickstarted Western civilization really came from that new form of communication. More than 1,800 years later, when the printing press was introduced in Europe, modern civilization began its meteoric rise because the knowledge that had been restricted to elites was suddenly dispersed to the masses, triggering a wave of literacy. An adult can learn to read and write in 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, the wisdom that had been collected by the ancients was accessible, not just to elites, but to the masses. And over time, people began to think, whoa, maybe I can write something. And then Shakespeare and Cervantes and then journals that became newspapers, and suddenly the ancient Greek dream of self-governance and democracy burst forth again, and the Enlightenment changed our civilization again, and those migrants, the brave and the few and the rebellious who came to North America, brought with them the fullest flower of the Enlightenment, and that's the United States of America. If the printing press caused such a sweeping change in civilization over centuries, the global mind is causing an even larger change and much more quickly. And there are some perils, and we need to keep an eye on them. We have a stalker economy now where many businesses treat their customers as their products. If you look up a word on dictionary.com right now on your smartphone, that business will, without you knowing it, place 234 small computer programs on your device that will track your movements around the internet from now on. And there are many businesses that do that. And the aggregate cumulative digital files that are compiled are mostly benign. They're just trying to sell them to advertisers so they can direct advertisements that you're more likely to be interested in. But they're selling them to private investigators, and they're selling them to anybody who will pay them money. And I wonder when we will reach our gag point. The government, I'm the farthest thing from an anti-government conspiracy theorist, but our government is now completing this year a $2 billion facility in Utah run by the National Security Agency that will sweep up every telephone call and every email and every text and keep it on file. If there's a terrorist conspiracy, we want them to be able to uncover it quickly. And it's most unlikely we'd ever have another future president like Richard Nixon, or that we'd have to worry. My faith tradition teaches that knowledge is power. Our shared secular faith, handed to us by our founders, teaches that too much power in the hands of any one branch of government is potentially a threat to liberty. We need to be on guard to insist that privacy and data security be honored and respected. It's not a trivial matter. It's one of many examples in this book of how human values must be respected and honored. There's so many other dimensions to this, but let me move on. Speaking of power, the economic and political power relationships in the world are now undergoing a more profound change than any humankind has experienced in 500 years since the Europeans discovered the Americas. China is going to surpass the U.S. as the most powerful economy in the world in the next few years. Last week, it officially became the largest trading nation. The U.S. has been the most powerful economy in the world for more than 100 years. But it's not just China that is rising. Power is shifting from west to east, and it is being resorted into emerging centers of power all over the world. For all of the decades since the end of World War II, and especially since the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the disappearance of communism as a serious idea, the United States has enforced what some call Pax Americana. The world has experienced a period of progress and relative peace that has, in the main, led to the spread of values that we believe are important. Democratic capitalism, a compound ideology representing the perceived superiority of democracy and capitalism as a means of organizing politics and economics respectively, has become an ideological hegemon in the world. But both democracy and capitalism have been hacked. And I say that not lightly. Let's take them one by one. Democracy has been hacked. Hacked is a computer term, of course, where someone takes over the operating system of a computer and directs it to do things that are contrary to what the owner of the computer wants it to do. I've had personal experience with the operating system of democracy. When I was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1976, I started having town hall meetings. I called them open meetings. I can't even begin to tell you what a thrill it put into my heart. Really and truly, this sounds corny, but I want you to feel what I felt. In going to the 25 rural counties in Middle Tennessee that I was privileged to represent, people would stand up and pour their hearts out and say what they think needed to be changed in the federal government. You remember that Norman Rockwell painting of a man standing up in the town hall meeting? It was like that, really. I mean, again, without being corny, I could almost hear the battle hymn of the Republic hummed in the background. Really and truly, it was a thrill. And I'd go to Washington and I'd fight for my constituents and learn things and go back and tell them why I'd voted differently from what they might have done and give them the reasons why. And that's the way it's supposed to work. And as a politician, I was hoping they'd know that I was working hard for them and recognize it and then reelect me. And our founders intended for exactly those incentives to be planted in my heart and mind as a representative. And it worked. It was amazing. Here's what I'm trying to communicate here. It does not work that way anymore. And here's why. It's not complicated. We don't operate on the basis of shared information coming off the printing press anymore. Our political dialogue in America is mainly on television today. 80% of the money that is raised by Democrats and Republicans alike is used to buy 30-second TV ads. And they're not the Federalist Papers. They're these hot-button emotional deals. And in order to buy these TV ads, they got to have a lot of money. So there's been a big behavioral change. We had an election not too many months ago. And when the ones that just got elected went up there to Washington for their orientation sessions, they'd spend a little time with the parliamentarian and figuring out where their offices were. And then they'd go meet with their party caucuses. And here's what the parties told them, both parties. Each one of them would be told, "We've done the math, and here's how many millions of dollars you're going to have to raise between now and the time you run for re-election. And here's how many days between now and then. You divide one into the other, that means that you got to raise $15,000, $20,000, whatever, dollars per day, every day, between now and then. So tomorrow, we've got this room set up for you. And we've got lists of special interests and rich people for you to call." And they now spend 5 to 6 hours per day, every day, begging for money from business lobbies and rich people and special interests. That's what they do. That's how they're taught to be reelected. Now, here's the key point here. Remember, I told you about the incentives that were working on my mind and heart, being thrilled by the chance to play the role that our founders believe that a representative ought to play. It's a little bit different because now, human nature being what it is, if you spend 5 to 6 hours a day begging rich people for money, you're not spending time in the committee hearings. You're not spending time on the floor of the Congress. They don't even do much on the floor of the Congress now. Anyway, really, I mean, they'll come in on Tuesday night and they'll go through the motions on Wednesday and then they'll go back to raising money on Thursday. So because of human nature, when they go to vote, they're naturally going to be thinking, what effect is that going to have on my telephone calls today? When I go to these cocktail parties and fundraisers, they're interested in a particular outcome. Capitalism has also been hacked. You have this green MBA program here. A few years ago, one of our leading business research firms did a big study of U.S. CEOs and CFOs, chief financial officers, and they asked them a series of questions, and one of them was this: here's an investment you can make in your business that'll make your business more profitable and more sustainable, stronger. It meets your internal investment targets. But if you make this investment, you will slightly miss your next quarterly earnings projection. Given those facts, will you make this investment? 80% of American CEOs and CFOs said no, will not make the investment, cannot afford to, can't even consider it, because we'll be penalized in the marketplace. We'll lose market capitalization. That is functionally insane, because it hurts the shareholders, it hurts the employees, it hurts the business, but it is done every single day. Because short-term incentives now drive the process. There's much more that I could and probably ought to talk about on that, but let me move on. Growth. Chapter 4 is outgrowth. I loved the president's speech last night at the State of the Union. I loved his inaugural address. But, you know, both the president and the Congress are focused on growth, and we're used to that. A week ago, the gross domestic product went down 0.1%, and there was a lot of arm waving about that. Every national economic policy, not only in this country, but in every country, is focused on growth. Every corporate business plan is focused on growth. It's the Holy Grail. It's equated with progress. If you're growing, it's good. If you're not, it's bad. What do we mean by growth? What is growth? The definition of growth in economics actually is fairly precise, and it has a history. Now, human nature, again, being what it is, we are vulnerable to latching on to a shortcut or a heuristic, something that is easy to remember and stands for something more complicated. And that's what GDP is, gross domestic product. That's the Holy Grail. And business accounting systems are derived from GDP. GDP was created in the 1930s. This is all in this book. And the man who was justly honored for creating the concept of GDP that stands for growth was a man named Simon Kuznets. Incidentally, I did a book signing in Chicago last week, Elaine, and one young man came through the line and said, "Thank you so much. I am Simon Kuznets' grandson." And I was so happy to meet him. Simon Kuznets was a great man, and he was honored for his creation, GDP. But when he was honored and when he made speeches accepting it and going forth, he said this, "Please," he said, "do not use GDP as a guide for economic policy." It's an advance. Thank you for honoring me. It really does help us understand what the economy is doing, but you cannot use it as a compass for setting the country's economic direction. You cannot use it as a dashboard for deciding what's good and what's bad. Why? Because GDP and the definition of growth that it encompasses leaves out a bunch of things. What does it leave out? Externalities. You've heard the word. It has a kind of an Orwellian memory hole feeling to it. Externalities means it's okay to forget about these things. They're externalities. What are the externalities? They're negative and positive. Negative externalities include pollution. Pollution flows do not show up on the profit and loss ledger. They do not show up on the national accounts. They are external to our consciousness about what we're doing and what's good and what's bad. Forget about them. Positive externalities. If we spend money on education, mental health care, art, music, culture, science, research, and development. That's an expense. The benefits then over time come rolling back in. Better educated children, richer communities, healthier families. But those positive externalities, they're ignored. They don't show up on the ledger. They're not counted in the calculations by which we decide what policies are good and what policies are bad. What else is excluded? The depreciation of natural resources. What else is excluded? The distribution of income. Inequality in where the growth produces benefits is completely invisible in the design of our economic policies. It's completely ignored. So, for example, since the Great Recession, we have been struggling mightily to get growth. GDP, we've got to get the economy moving again. And we cheer when we get a little growth. Since 2009, since we began this recovery, 93% of all the additional national income in the U.S. has gone to the top 1%. But that's a win, right? Not for the middle class. Not for the bottom 99%. I'm not aping the Occupy vocabulary here. I'm just reporting the facts. Let me give you one example. And I'm not picking on this family. They're a great family and they're great people. But the family that founded Walmart, two brothers, Sam and Bud Walton, have five children and one daughter-in-law in the second generation. These six individuals now have more wealth than the bottom 100 million Americans. The bottom one-third of our country. Is that good? No, it's not good. Is it measured? No, we ignore it. So growth needs to be redefined, and we need to stop relying on this shortcut. And growth takes many forms. Population. Our species emerged in roughly our modern form 200,000 years ago, give or take. It took 200,000 years for us to reach a population of 1 billion people. We've added that many, 1 billion people, in the first 13 years of this century. 200,000 years, 13 years. In the next 13 years, we'll add another billion. And in the 14 years after that, another billion. We have quadrupled human population in less than a century. We have grown to the point where we have a big impact. And we're pressing upon some crucial resources like fresh water, particularly underground water resources, and topsoil that is not replenished very quickly, and the web of living species with whom we share this planet. The fifth driver of global change is the reinvention of life and death, the revolution in the life sciences, in genetics, genomics, proteomics, new materials sciences, nanotechnology. We have now acquired the ability to change the fabric of life itself, to change the makeup of all solid matter. We can splice genes. We have seen the invention of brand new life forms that have never appeared in nature. Now, I'm from the South. We have something called kudzu there. It just spread like crazy. What about some brand new little critter, microbial or otherwise? It's another example of how we need to be alert to make sure. I don't want to overstate the danger, because there's so many blessings from this revolution. My goodness, cures for new diseases, alleviation of pain and horrible conditions that have bedeviled humankind since our beginning. So it's a great thing. But some of these developments do require us to be conscious and participate in making decisions about where we go. I'll give you a quick example. Spider, anybody here have a spider goat? No. Let me tell you about spider goats. Spider silk is incredibly valuable. If you have enough of it, it's stronger than steel and is flexible and tensile, and it's very valuable. But it's hard to get a lot of it because you can't really farm spiders. They're aggressive and cannibalistic, and those are only two of the reasons I don't want to farm spiders. But here's what you can do and what some people are now doing. You can take the genes from orb-weaving spiders and splice them into goats and produce spider goats. And they look like goats, but they secrete spider silk through their udders with their milk. Everybody okay with that? At least one person is. But somebody, I thought I heard the word creepy. Creepy's not fear, it's pre-fear. Something's going on, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? We may need to be aware. What about selecting the traits of children? Are parents competitive? Here's the menu. What kind of eye color do you want? What hair color? Do you want more intelligence? Countries are competitive. China has announced and is proceeding to become the world superpower in genetic engineering, scanning children's genomes, matching them with the professions they believe they might be most suited for, trying to find the genetic traits that may be associated with higher intelligence, exploring genetic enhancements. We can clone people now. Nobody's doing it, as far as we know, because there is an ethical prohibition. What other ethical guidelines should we be looking at? Anyway, let me conclude. The sixth driver of global change. You'd be surprised if one of these six in a book written by me wasn't the climate crisis. And it is. I won't say much about it because I've spoken here before and you know what I feel. And you know more about the reality of this in the year that we've just been through. 2012 was the hottest year ever measured in North America. The fires in the West, once again, were out of control. 60% plus of our country was in deep drought this past year. Much of it still is. The worst outbreak of West Nile virus in history, 48 of our 50 states. In Texas, the epicenter this past year, many police departments put out public appeals for people to stop dialing 911 when they got a mosquito bite. True. Many climate-related disasters. $110 billion worth of climate-related disasters last year. Never in history. The second biggest was the year before when we had $60 billion. 14 different climate-related disasters costing more than $1 billion each. We had Superstorm Sandy this year, devastating Manhattan, New Jersey, and some other places. When I put out my movie a few years back, An Inconvenient Truth, the single most common criticism by the deniers and cynics was when they said, that was demagogic and irresponsible for you to show an animation of sea level rise that had the ocean water going into the World Trade Center Memorial Site. How could that happen? It happened at the end of last October. Half of the North Polar ice cap melted last summer. In spite of all of this that happened last year, in a year of a presidential election characterized by more presidential debates than in any election in history, not one single reporter asked a single question of any candidate in any of the debates about the climate crisis. Ladies and gentlemen, that is pathetic. It is a comment on the quality of our democratic discourse. We are now putting 90 million tons of global warming pollution every day into the atmosphere as if it's an open sewer. More than 100 years ago, they discovered what caused cholera, which was one of the biggest killers in history. A man named John Snow in London mapped the cases of cholera and overlaid the map on the sewer system of London and traced it to a single pump on Broad Street. And not long after, Louis Pasteur discovered bacteria was the culprit. They connected the dots. We got to connect the dots here. The sky is not a sewer. But we've put so much man-made global warming pollution up there already that every day it is trapping enough extra heat to equal the energy released by 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs going off every single day. It's a big planet, but that's a lot of energy. And that's what's drying out the soil and making the droughts deeper. That's what's evaporating the water off the oceans and filling the sky with water vapor, triggering these huge floods and downpours. Last week in Australia and Queensland, they had 2.5 feet of rain in 48 hours. 2 years ago in my home city of Nashville, thousands of my neighbors lost their businesses and homes, and none of them had flood insurance because it had never flooded in the areas affected. It was a once in a thousand year rainfall, they said. There are a lot of communities that have a once in a thousand year, once in 500 year event every few years now. We've got to connect the dots. Our civilization has grown. Our technologies are more powerful. We have wondrous new opportunities, but we need to be conscious of the risks that we are posing to future generations. The future is an effort to put all of these six drivers of change together, to see how they interrelate with one another. And I hope you read it, I hope you enjoy it, I hope you learn from it. More than any of that, I hope that you will read it with your hearts and minds open to the possibility that you personally can be an active agent for positive change in making the future what it should be. Thank you very much. I look forward to your questions. Thank you. Thank you very much. Sorry if I went on too long.
You did it. Maybe you're not having it. Perfect.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
What a night. Thank you, Vice President Gore. I'm going to start with the first question from a student. Domingo Ramirez has asked a question. He's graduating from Dominican in May, and he's going to have a degree in ecology and environmental science. But he wants to know, with this background, would it be more effective for him to pursue a chain of career as a scientist, or should he start going into politics and become an elective official?
Well, I always encourage young people who may be drawn toward politics to do that. But I think that politics is a profession that all of us should be involved in, even if we're not running for office. And a scientist who is politically active and feels an obligation to inform the public debate can also play a powerful role. I'd want to know more about this young person's life and ideals before really giving such advice. I honor the profession of politics very much, but I honor those who are in other walks of life who are like that Norman Rockwell painting, who bring their expertise from their day job into their advocacy as a citizen.
Thank you. I have a couple questions here from people who have been watching television and have noticed that people who are sort of running political campaigns and fundraising one day are on TV the next, maybe next hour, as experts telling us what we're supposed to think. How do we deal with that?
Yeah.
Seems to be a career path now.
Well, you can change the channel. but it's almost as if the news media treats politics like professional hockey or baseball or football. It's like a horse race, and that's the metaphor most often used. It's trivialized. And again, they look for shortcuts, heuristics, templates that don't require people to think very hard. Who's ahead? Who's up in the poll, down in the poll? What about the ideas? You know, what about the proposals? What about our future? What are we going to do? I honestly think, and you've heard me say this before, Elaine, I honestly think that television has kind of dumbed down democracy quite a bit. During the age of the printing press, I talked about this earlier, but I give a specific example. Thomas Paine, in January of 1776, had emigrated from England to Philadelphia, didn't have a penny to his name, didn't have any family connections, any base of power or influence, but he could think really clearly and he could write really well. And he wrote Common Sense. And he could walk out his front door in Philadelphia and find 10 low-cost print shops within 12 blocks. And he printed Common Sense, and people read it and said, wow, and they gave it to their friends and neighbors, and it became the Harry Potter of the late 18th century. And it helped to ignite the American Revolution. Today, a modern Thomas Paine in Philadelphia could walk out his front door and walk down to the television station not far from there, or Comcast a few blocks farther away, and tell them, hey, I've got this new video presentation called Common Sense. It's going to change everything. When do I go on the air? Well, they'd say, you know, a half hour costs $10 million, an hour costs $25 million. Give us the money. Well, he doesn't have the money. Corporations have the money. And, you know, every news and commentary show now is sponsored by the banks, the pharmaceutical companies, and the fossil fuel companies, clean coal. And when they show you those ads for clean coal, do you think they're trying to get you to say to your spouse or partner, honey, I'm going to go down to the store and buy us some coal? No. No, they're trying to condition your political thinking. And that's how it works now. And it's kind of deadening our democracy. But if the printing press was act one in this play, and the television media scape is act two, act three is the internet. And the internet is still in its infancy, but it's coming on strong. And already, individual bloggers are having an impact on the course of public debates. Young people who are so connected to the internet are more engaged and involved with their communities and doing good works than any generation in my lifetime. I think it's very, very promising. And conversations are affected. we have to use the internet and use our conversations to lift up democracy. I remember when I was a kid, very young, growing up in the summers in Tennessee, I remember when the conversation was won on civil rights. An acquaintance of mine made some semi-racist comment, and one of my other friends said, "Hey, shut up, we don't go for that." And in a million places that happened, and our country changed. Still needs to change more, but it changed. Last week there was a wonderful story about an incident where two gay men were waiting in a long line to buy some pizza. And they were holding hands, and some homophobe made a hateful comment, and literally everybody else in the line turned and said, "Hey, we don't go for that." We're winning that conversation. We have to win the conversation on the climate crisis. And let me make a personal appeal to you. Many of you have friends and family members who are attracted to climate denial, who reject the science. When they make those comments, don't let them pass. Be loving. Don't be hateful or use violent language. I'm serious. Be firm. Be firm. This is not a trivial matter. We have to win that conversation. Go ahead.
That brings me to a question that rather surprised me, but probably won't surprise you. A lot of people talk about core values, and this person wants to know, what do you think the core values are of these climate denying folks?
Well, that is a very interesting question. First of all, there's a section in this book that reports on some really interesting research that's been piling up in the last several years about the difference between what we call liberals and what we call conservatives. And, you know, being where we are and people self-select and they choose where to live and what events to go to, I'd just hazard a wild guess that they're probably more liberals than conservatives in this group. But, but, all right, yay us. But there are more than a few conservatives in this group, I guarantee you. And here's what the new research shows. It's pretty surprising. But when you think about it, it kind of makes sense. These researchers over the last several years have asked a series of questions in countries around the world, and they're real general questions. They're not about, you know, do you favor gun control, you do favor gay rights or something like that. It's way more general. Questions sort of, I'm not doing justice to it, but sort of like, would you rather try new things and discover new ways of doing things, or are you more likely to say, hold on, let's appreciate what we have, let's don't get radical here, and you know those, and there are a whole series of questions like that. And what the answers show, in every country, regardless of ethnicity, culture, gender, race, anything, the breakdown is almost exactly the same in every country and in every population. Isn't that interesting? And you can speculate that we as human beings have an advantage, a survival advantage, if when we approach problems that affect communities and our civilization, if there are some people who are temperamentally inclined to try new things. Let's see what works. This isn't working very well. Let's try something new. And others who are temperamentally inclined to say, hold on here, not so fast. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and when both of those temperaments are given a fair hearing, and there's a respectful interchange of ideas and perspectives, we're more likely to make good decisions. But when those temperaments are weaponized, when those who are temperamentally inclined to be conservative are tribalized and fed information that reinforces their fear of doing anything new, or you can take the other side when those who are more inclined to be liberal are just ginned up to just really be angry at those, and in a political structure where huge amounts of money give preferential access and electronic megaphones to one temperament, and the others are kind of, Fox News, stop. Then, instead of communicating and working together and making better decisions, then what you get is all this fighting. And I think that climate has been made by the people with the megaphones, who incidentally, a lot of them get a lot of money from the climate, from the large carbon polluters. They took a page out of the tobacco industry's playbook. This has all been documented. There's a book called Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes and her co-author. And there was a brand new study just published last week, funded by the National Cancer Institute, published in a peer-reviewed journal, that documents the tobacco industry and fossil fuel companies seeding the money for the Tea Party's creation more than 15 years ago. And you can look it up. The author was a man named Glanz, G-L-A-N-Z. A Dr. Google will find it for you. And so I think that the core values of deniers, a lot of people just have this temperament saying, hey, I'm not going to be stampeded by people saying there's a climate crisis. I'm going to hold on to the values that I feel comfortable with. But some of them have been given a lot of misinformation and have been stampeded toward extremely irresponsible, self-destructive positions. A lot of them are good people, and they just don't hear anything except one side of it. And it's a problem. It really is a problem. And when you have all this propaganda, they spend a lot of money doing this. We have a saying in Tennessee, if you see a turtle on top of a fence post, it's a pretty good bet that it didn't get there by itself. If you see all these deniers repeating the same thing over and over and over again, it's a pretty good bet that didn't happen spontaneously. They're being fed that information.
I have several questions in here about Congress, and we do not have climate deniers in our representatives here, but how do we get to those people who are sitting in Congress and making these decisions and having to raise this money? Somebody brought that one up too, so that we can bring our democracy back.
Well, some of them just need to be defeated when they run for re-election, I think. but they don't. They're not the ones running in Marin County.
No.
So here's some things that I think ought to be done. As at a minimum, the Congress ought to pass the pending disclose legislation, which very simply would require legally that nobody can make anonymous contributions, that their names have to be disclosed. Now, secondly, I really believe that we need to overturn the Citizens United case that declares corporations as people. And by the way, this book traces the history of the legal reasoning in Citizens United. And there is a to me, a fascinating history that from 1871, which is the first case that designated corporations as persons using the newly adopted 14th Amendment to give personhood to freed slaves, to use it to give personhood to corporations instead. And then in 1971, when Justice Lewis Powell expanded that doctrine, both of those cases were cited in Citizens United. It's not going to be easy to enact a constitutional amendment, which many believe may be required to overturn Citizens United, but if those who share the values that so many of us have are willing and sufficiently determined to win a few presidential elections in a row, we'll change the makeup of the Supreme Court, and then they can overturn Citizens United.
Yes. I know we could all stay here all night and talk to Vice President Gore. Thank you for being so generous with your time. I tell you, you are going to love this book. It is something you are going to be so happy you have in your home. And you can change the world. I'm sure going to try. Thanks to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. God bless. Thank you, dear. Thank you. Oh.